5,
4,
3,
2,
1. Hold on, there's a dog barking now. Alright, try that again.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Should I just continue in it anyway?
Yeah, just keep going.
With me again is Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
Yeah, what's up, Jabber Draws and Drone Strikes? With me, as always, is the founder, the L. Ron Hubbard of the Jabber and the Drone, from Los Angeles, California, film critic Cassidy Robinson.
Ooh, fancy. I'm glad that I'm the L. Ron Hubbard, I guess, and not the Jim Jones of Jabber and the Drone.
Well, I guess it just depends on how this whole podcast thing ends for us.
Yeah, or the Haley's Comet guy, whatever his name was. Today, we're going to be reviewing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and in the Netflix homework, I'm going to try and remember it once, I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Yeah, you got it.
Things happen. This weekend was Free Comic Book Day. Did you do anything fun?
Well, for Free Comic Book Day, not really. I coach an improv team, and I get done after noon, and Ashley works till then anyway. So we didn't get to the comic book shop till late, and everything was pretty much gone. They were doing sales and stuff, but I just wanted to kind of browse what the free comics were. So not really. But then we went to the Old Sod, which is a little Irish pub just down the road, to watch the Kentucky Derby, which has become something of a tradition of ours, watching the Kentucky Derby.
I'm offended by everything you just said right now. Deeply, deeply offended.
No, the Kentucky Derby's perfect. It allows me to care about sports for exactly 2 minutes every year.
I'm not even completely sure what the Kentucky Derby is. All I heard was, blah, 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 didn't do anything about Comic Book Day, watch sports instead.
No, we tried to do stuff for Free Comic Book Day, but the nerds had grubbed all the grubs. And so we went and watched the ponies.
Because you have a gambling addiction.
I do.
That's a new thing.
I've actually bet on horse races before, and I did all right.
Well, I did things. I did a couple things.
I didn't even tell you about the sweet Kentucky Derby party that was going on because you were over there judging. So we got to the Old Sod, and they have like this new back room area, and legit, there was this Irish football. Irish women's football team that was holding a party, and you got a raffle ticket, you could buy like a little bag, and they gave you a drink voucher for a mint julep.
Well, I guess I'm glad you did something then. I went to North Hollywood, and we hit up a few different shops. My friend up there, she lived next to a shop, so within walking distance, so we did that first, which was the busiest one of the bunch, actually.
Well, surprisingly. You went to multiples? You did a free comic crawl?
Yeah, we did a free comic crawl. We did the whole thing. We nerded it out the whole day. So we did that. Then we went to a shop that was also in North Hollywood.
I hope you didn't pay a single goddamn cent for those comics.
Well, except for the ones that I did pay for.
You motherfucker.
No.
It is Free Comic Book Day.
But, well, one of the things, and maybe people don't know this, they just think Free Comic Book Day, and then they see that's like Mickey Mouse comics and like movie tie-in stuff, because a lot of it is that. The shops that you go to will often have deals going on because they know there's going to be more people there than usual. So a lot of stuff was 50 to 40% off, that kind of stuff. And at one of the shops I went to, I was able to find for relatively cheap a brand new copy of the graphic novel My Friend Dahmer, which I wanted to read before the movie came out this year.
Oh, yeah.
And Daredevil Yellow, which I've been questing for like 2 years. So I got those super cheap. And then also, I you know, at the multiple shops that I went to, I was able to grab pretty much everything that looked remotely interesting to me out of the Free Comic Book stuff. We went to the Nerd Melt at one point. We took a Uber down there because the small shop, the other shop in North Hollywood we were going to go to, actually had this ridiculous line that was moving like at a snail's pace. So we're like, well, we might as well just go to Hollywood. So we did that. We
went to the stars get their free comics.
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I'm sure, you know, probably earlier in the day, they're maybe incognito or something. But yeah, so we went there, and then we went back and watched Guardians 2, which we'll be talking about today. So we did it up. We did the whole thing. Oh, also, we went to this amazing restaurant, which I'd never been to before in Hollywood after the Nerd Melt, called The Griddle. That's in walking distance.
I was really hoping you were going to say something like Soup Plantation.
We went to this place, or Panera Bread. Have you ever heard of this place? No, it was this place called The Griddle, where you can get like cartoonishly large pancakes, larger than the plate they serve them on. Okay, let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
All right.
I gotta find my phone.
I feel like we need more. You mentioned this once when we did a guest on the Listening Party podcast that we need more
transition like, music,
sound effects. Yeah, like I feel like we need a like a movie news. talking about that movie news.
That's you. Yeah, that's all you. No. You're responsible for finding our transition music.
I'm not a DJ.
We only have two stories, so we can talk about them at some length. Let's go ahead and get this one out of the way because it's not as exciting.
Okay.
This one here, I'm pulling up on my phone right now. This is the playlist that I'm reading it off of, and the headline is Ben Stiller, Benicio Del Toro, and Patricia Arquette team up for Escape from Clinton Correctional. And it is a Showtime series that Ben Stiller will be directing with Benicio Del Toro and Patricia Arquette. The project will dramatize that incredible and wild true story of Richard Matt and David Sweet, who broke out of the titular maximum security prison in New York with the help of employee Joyce Mitchell, who wanted Richard to kill her husband. So, it's a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm a fan of Ben Stiller as a director. Yeah, I don't care one way or another. I think it's interesting though that like I was thinking about this as we were watching the Netflix homework.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the whole thing about how Hollywood talks about people in Hollywood talk about how all those people in Hollywood, all the trades talk about how they don't make you know like $30 million movies anymore. Mm-hmm. They all have to be like, you know, $500 million movies, billion dollar movies. And it's right. Kind of
true. And or their niche kind of boutique division kind of indies.
Yeah,
the tadpoles and the tentpoles.
I think that TV is kind of absorbing what used to be the $30 million movie.
Sure.
Like, I think that still exists. It just, you know, now it's on HBO in a 10-episode miniseries, and it's, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just,
yeah.
The more I think about it, the more I don't care. Like, it used to make me grumpy because I'm like, they don't make movies like this anymore. But I'm like, they're making up for it. Like, the gap is getting filled. And this, to me, this feels like it'll probably be something like that.
Yeah, it could be cool. And I agree with you. I really like Ben Stiller as a director. I mean, generally speaking, I've liked all of the movies he's been behind. Well, the Walter Mitty one was kind of whatever. But everything else...
I liked Walter Mitty. Walter Mitty, all right. It was fine.
It was... Exactly. It was fine. It didn't... I'd rather watch almost anything else he's done. But yeah, I think that something like this sounds challenging, sounds interesting, sounds new for him. I'd like to see him work in long form. You know, he hasn't done that since the Ben Stiller Show back in the early 90s.
And I don't know if that's even really the same, because that was like sketch.
It was sketch comedy, and there was multiple directors and stuff on it. It was his baby, but you know, it wasn't like a auteur-ish kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say this will be either, but you know. I am a little surprised, though, because the last I heard on Twitter a long time ago was Ben Stiller was diagnosed with cancer.
What?
Yeah, this was... Unless I'm remembering this wrong, in which case I'm very sorry. But I thought this was...
Sorry to break it to you, Ben, on the Jabber and the Drone podcast with its 30 listeners a week, and I know you're one of them.
Yeah, but that was, I thought I read that like a year ago. Maybe it was treated and he's fine and he's moving on with projects, but
hopefully. I'm Googling it right now. Yeah, apparently that's true. The little soundbite is Ben Stiller prostate cancer test saved my life. So sounds like it was treated.
Treated, and he's doing good now. Okay, good. Well, then I'm excited, and we'll see.
Yeah.
Although I don't have Showtime, so I have no idea how I'll see.
Well, you can get, like, any of the premies.
Nope. Still no.
Which is the... Yeah, that's...
that's something else.
The premium networks and babies that are born too soon. Same thing. You can get all the premies as add-ons through Amazon now, pretty much.
Right. Yeah, which I will not do, but I'm sure at some point it'll be more accessible and I can find it and watch it. If I hear that it's really good and worth watching.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's get to it. This is the story everyone really cares about.
That's right. Our feed was blowing up.
Well, the internet really blew up. You know, this was one of those kind of drops. Do you want to... What was it? Lay it on us.
Mike Mignola. That's right. You heard it. Mike Mignola said they're rebooting Hellboy.
Mm-hmm. Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy.
The comic book, mm-hmm. printed by Dark Horse. Yeah, he came out and on Twitter, which I guess is where... Or it might have been Facebook. I don't know. He said, there's going to be another Hellboy movie. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an R-rated reboot directed mm-hmm. by Neil Marshall and starring David Harbour of Stranger Things fame as Hellboy.
Neil Marshall, the director of The Descent and Doomsday.
And some of the best episodes of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. All the
real violent ones.
The battle stuff, especially. And I didn't know this. He was Emmy nominated for some of his work on Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, he did... He's pretty much the guy that get to do all the really big battle sequences, mm-hmm. which are really hard to film. But, you know, he's good at doing those on a reasonable budget.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's interesting because I remember earlier in the year, Ron Perlman... and not Benicio del Toro, that's the other one, Guillermo del Toro, they're brothers.
they're not.
Yeah, they're related. That's a fact. Yeah, I think it was Ron Perlman. I think it was both of them were like actively campaigning to try and get, Hellboy 3 made because, mm-hmm. Guillermo del Toro had planned it as a trilogy, and the third one had just, you know, it just never got made for various reasons.
Uh-huh.
Which is a shame. You know, I wanted to see where Guillermo del Toro would take his final installment.
Sure.
And I know Ron Perlman, you know, was sort of a career defining role for him.
Yeah, but to be fair, it's Ron Perlman. And I'm not saying that, like, in a shady way. Like, I like Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
But he is a character actor, and, you know, generally speaking, he's always, like, plays tertiary characters and stuff. He's done a lot of TV and voice work and that kind of stuff. But the Hellboy series is really the only, like, series that he led.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
or any film he's led.
And I love me some Ron Perlman, but he's not the type of actor that, you know, and this was back in, like, the early 2000s when, you know, where, like, the other comic book movies that it was competing with were X-Men and Spider-Man, and, you know. Yeah.
Comic book movies 2.0. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's saying something that he held two movies on his own. So, like, I get why he's attached to the role, and I thought he was great in the role. So let's talk about this new movie.
Yeah, well, let's, you asked our friend Hillary, I guess listens to us pretty regularly, so shout out to Hill.
Hi, Hillary. Oh, and this one's for you. God damn it, Cassidy.
Alright. You asked her to chime in since she's listening and she has opinions.
Yeah, well, she posted on Facebook. She just said, I have concerns and comments, and I wanted to know exactly what they were. So.
She says, it's mostly the lack of Ron Perlman, and I'm not into comic book movies going R just because. I mean, I like Deadpool and I dug Logan. Does Hellboy even have enough messed up stuff that could be pushed to R? Yeah, probably. I just don't know if it needs to be like that. I do like the actor who they're talking about. So yeah, my concerns and comments. So that's, you know, we can turn this into something of a discussion since we don't have a lot of news. I am sort of two minds. I think I'm actually not against this. Like, as you know, as much as I like Guillermo del Toro, as much as he had a very specific vision for that project that is very much tied in with his aesthetic. I don't even necessarily think that those movies are altogether great movies. I think that they are. I know. Listen, hear me out, internet. I like those movies a great deal. Mostly because of the art direction, mostly because of the characters' work. I think there's great characters in those movies, and obviously that's the stuff that Guillermo del Toro attached himself the most to, was his creature designs, his production design, and the character stuff. The stories, as they work, or the plots specifically, are kind of loosey-goosey. They sort of move in fits and starts. They're not the most well put together
again,
action movies. There's some really good action scenes and special effects moments, but, like, the overallness of each movie, if you think about them in terms of, like, especially if you're thinking of, like, how comic book movies have sort of developed and sort of tightened up since then, those movies, you know, are kind of shaggy dogs, and that's sort of why I like them. I like how idiosyncratic they are, but I think there is
recently,
room.
I watched Hellboy 2 again, like, just a few months ago, actually. And, you know, it holds up. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally.
I agree with you that I think they sort of suffer from the fact that they were, I kind of agree with you. I enjoy the hell out of them. They're a lot of fun, but they feel a little too superhero-y. And I think that comes from the time they came out. You know, it was like,
sure,
Hellboy has to be a superhero. But in the comic books, that's not really what he is. He's just sort of a dude from hell.
Yeah,
and they get that aspect of the character, but they portray it with, like, this whole secret society of the BPRD, and he has to be hidden. And it's like, Hellboy never gave a fuck. He just, like, did his job. He was so blue-collar and... And I think
there's sort of a camp aspect to the first two movies that I think is very much intentional. But I think that you're right in that, like, the tone that was set by, like, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies kind of dictated how comic book movies were made until Nolan kind of reinvented the wheel. And then that almost kind of overcorrected the other direction. But, you know,
well,
I think
and then Marvel came along and turned the wheel into an iPad that they can, you know, sell every every year.
Yeah, for better or worse.
I'm not into this. I do have concerns about the R rating.
Well, here's what I'm thinking about this. If they're going to have Hellboy just like saying fuck all over the place, or they're going to just because, or they're going to have like some raunchy sex scene or something, or they're going to make it like, you know, grotesquely violent, like to the point that it just becomes splatter schlock, which Neil Marshall is capable of doing.
Oh, absolutely. That's I think his directorial signature is a head exploding in everything he does.
Right. Then I would be kind of annoyed. If it turned into Punisher Warzone, I'd be kind of annoyed. Well, I'd be very annoyed. But
I'm afraid of that because
I'll finish what I mean.
Okay.
That would be the worst I think they could do with this project. But what I hope they do, and where I see the R rating could be helpful, is if they push the subject matter into darker, more sinister territories and let it be scary. Because that, I think, could be cool. You know, because as fun as those Hellboy movies are, the Guillermo del Toro ones, none of the monsters of stuff, unless you're very, very young and sensitive, really registers as scary.
Those tooth fairies are a little creepy when they're first introduced, but for the most part, I agree.
Mm-hmm. And I think if, you know, you went to sort of that descent territory with the monster stuff...
But see, that's where you kind of... Okay, so, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely... I'm into them bringing more horror into it, because mm-hmm. that is sort of what the Hellboy series started as, mm-hmm. was...
And more occult and more, yeah.
But I think they could pull all of that off still with a PG-13. I don't see the source material. Like, I would be pretty comfortable with, you know, like anyone... if I had a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were in high school, I would not feel weird about them reading Hellboy. If they were in junior high, I wouldn't feel that. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
there's
right.
nothing in there that to me merits that.
Okay.
And that's what makes me a little uncomfortable, is I don't want them to push for it just because it's Neil Marshall and just because Deadpool,
And has, Logan.
Yeah, has everyone, all of the studio executives with giant boners saying, we gotta get all heroes to swear now. Like, Hellboy doesn't swear. You know, he says, crap. Like, that's his... Again, he's very blue-collar, so it wouldn't be completely out of character every once in a while, but I just don't see the need for that. But, that being said... That's pretty much the only thing I have reservations with. I think, David Harbour.
Oh, the actor. Yeah.
Yeah. I was more into the idea of him playing Cable, because I know he was up for that role. Mm-hmm. I think, to me, he fit that a little bit better than Josh Brolin. But whatever, that's a whole other thing. That'll be fine. But I can see it. I can see him... He has that blue-collar quality. I don't think he's mm-hmm. quite as charming as Ron Perlman. But I think if they go more of a horror direction, it could be really cool. I am a little nervous about that R rating.
Yeah, I don't want it to be... Again, I don't want it to go into schlock territory. And I don't want it to...
Yeah, it doesn't need it. That's just not who that character is.
Mm-hmm. I can see the R rating kind of thing, like, or at least just sort of the...
I mean, we live in a world right now where Preacher, by mm-hmm. Garth Ennis, is on cable.
Mm-hmm.
But Hellboy is getting talked about for an R rating. Like it's crazy banana pants. like look at the properties you're buying, and if you want them to, you know, if... You want to serve the property the best, just, like, do what's successful about the property. Like, where's my R-rated Neil Marshall Preacher?
Yeah,
and my Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg Hellboy series. Where's that? Where's that at? Like, what? It's Cuckoo Bananas, I'm telling you. Like, I don't know.
You have a point. I don't know. How much faith do we put into this just because it's been properly endorsed by Mike Mignola? Is he kind of a shill? That's
true. I mean, back to Hellboy 3, he was talking it up for a while himself. So, mm-hmm. But maybe this is why the Hellboy 3 ship has sailed. Also, you know, I do think Ron Perlman is I'm sorry, Ronnie Pearls, but you're a little too old. And Guillermo del Toro is busy not making the 5 movies he's rumored to be making.
I think that has more to do with it than anything.
I get that his Hellboy 3 just isn't going to happen. And it makes me a little sad, but I'm excited that the property isn't just dead. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, Hellboy is one of my favorite comic books of all time.
And
there's so much material there to mine,
mm-hmm.
that if they do it right.
And the tone of the comic is very different than those movies. And I would like to see something closer to that. Something a little bit more esoteric and something, he's a fun character, but yeah.
The tone of the comic changes a lot. Like, originally, when Hellboy came about, he was just trying to create kind of a Jack Kirby character to mm-hmm. fight these Lovecraftian monsters. So it starts out very Lovecraftian, but then, like, by the end of it, it gets into full-on just, like, folklore and fairy lore. Like, so, you know, and you see that in the Guillermo del Toro stuff. Like, there's a troll market. Mm-hmm. That, to me, felt like it belonged in the world of Hellboy. But I also feel like we're missing the horrors skulking in the dark part of Hellboy. Like,
uh-huh.
That's what I mean. There's so much in those books that, you know, Guillermo del Toro picked the stuff out that he liked and that worked for his vision. And I think it worked great. Uh-huh. And I definitely think there is more stuff for them to work with.
Mm-hmm.
To go in a different direction. So, I don't know.
I'm not offended by this. I'm actually fairly curious. I'd like to follow the story a little bit more, see what kind of, like, concept art and stuff we see coming out early. I'm going to keep my eyes on it.
As an AMC series, and that
I think it'd be way too expensive for that.
I don't know what's expensive anymore.
Okay, well, let's get into the movie.
Yeah.
Which is Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2. This one kind of snuck up on me. You know, as big of a fan as I was of the first Guardians of the Galaxy, when I was looking at this year's release schedule, and I saw that Part 2 was coming out already, I felt like, God damn, that just barely came out.
I'm the total opposite, because I've been waiting for this since... we saw the footage at Comic-Con last year, which I can tell you finally what they showed. The breakout scene with Yondu and Rocket.
Which is a fun sequence, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they show that at Comic-Con, which was definitely enough to get me super excited.
Yes.
Yeah, so I've been waiting for this for quite a while.
James Gunn returns as the writer-director, mm-hmm. and...
If you don't know what's going on, Chris Pratt is back as Peter Quill, the Guardians of the Galaxy. It takes place just a little bit after Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an adventure guarding the galaxy.
Well, specifically, Peter Quill and Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Vin Diesel, kind of doing a voice again. Bradley Cooper is Rocket Raccoon. Michael Rooker is Yondu, who plays a bigger character in this movie than he did the other one.
Mm-hmm.
They made some bad trade deal. Then they get a super race of golden aliens mad at them. They're running across the galaxy to avoid them, and that's when they sort of get rescued by a strange man. I don't know how much I want to say about this man, but
it's not really a spoiler. They say it in the trailer.
Do they say, you know, I haven't seen the trailer. This is how much this movie snuck up on me. I don't even know what's in the trailers.
Well, so, it leaked pretty early who Kurt Russell was playing.
Okay.
And so, James Gunn just sort of leaned into the marketing and was like, yeah, okay, you figured it out. That's not going to ruin my movie. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's revealed within the first third of the movie, so I don't feel too bad saying Kurt Russell plays Peter Quill's long lost space father.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, trying to, like, reconnect with him on this planet that's essentially this sort of celestial heaven kind of thing. There's a B plot with Yondu and his crew and a mutiny that's going on over there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point, the two plots kind of collide in an unexpected way. You know, the tone of these movies are kind of different. I would say a little different than the usual Marvel thing. Those movies have a lot of funny parts, and certainly humor is a big part of what they do.
I think this was specifically Volume 2 was Marvel's first straight up just comedy.
Yeah, I mean, the other one was funny as well, but I felt like they really leaned into that here and really, this is, I mean, if the first one was kind of like Ice Pirates, this one is even more so.
Yeah, the first one is like, oh, this is fun, it's quirky and silly, but the second one is like, there's literally just making jokes a lot.
Yeah, it is, and there's more of a comedic expectancy from the dialogue. There's a lot more quips. It feels, you know, even kind of punched up in places.
Definitely.
A lot more visual gags. Straight up comedy, basically, with sci-fi action. And
for the most part, it worked for me. I will say, I do think some of the jokes felt a little flat. And I think part of it was, I think this is the first movie that Marvel has really over-marketed. Like, every time I see a trailer or something for a Marvel movie, I'm like, oh, I don't want to see too much. Mm-hmm. And then I see the full trailer, and I'm like, oh, they gave everything away. And then I see the movie, and I'm like, no, they left so much. And this one, I felt like a lot of the best stuff was in the trailers, and this is the first time I felt that in a Marvel movie, so I was a little disappointed there.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad I didn't see many trailers.
Yeah, so that sort of tainted my experience, and specifically with Drax, I felt like he worked a lot better in the first one, where he was this sort of straight man who would have these sort of deadpan moments, but they really play up. It was like he was sort of a runaway star of the first one. It was like, oh my God, he was so funny. Like, we can't believe that Dave Bautista has like humor, because he's just a mountain of meat. He is just meat piled upon meat. How can he make me laugh? So, and so this time I think they wrote him some of the funnier stuff, and it fell a little flat to me. I was like,
interesting.
I think he worked better as this sort of serious character that didn't realize he was goofy. And in this movie, it was like, oh yeah, he's Drax. He's goofy. Remember?
I get where you're coming from. I feel like that in general is going on in the movie. There's a whole lot of expected humor, whereas the first one, a lot of the humor kind of came out situationally. This one, it does feel a little bit more kind of punched up, as I was saying.
Yeah, and I just think, like, Chris Pratt and Bradley Cooper, Michael Rooker are just a little more natural with it than Dave Bautista is.
See, I'm going to disagree with you there, because I think that of all of the characters, I still thought that the humorous stuff involving him was what, for me, worked the best. Mostly because I thought I really like his comedic timing. There is some showboating with his character. There's, you know, some scenes where he's like, you know, there's a scene where he's being dragged by his spaceship and by like a rope or a chain or something like that, and they crash into something, and he said, that was awesome. That was kind of lame, just in general, just kind of a cliched sort of joke. But there's a lot of his like natural like misunderstanding stuff and stuff like that that we liked from the first movie, I think plays just as well here. And see, I'm still surprised by his comedic timing.
And don't get me wrong, I still like the character. I just, to me, a lot of his stuff just fell a little flat for me. I would have liked to see maybe Zoe Saldana, let her be a little sillier in this one, because she was sort of the straight person in the first one, and here again, she's sort of just their babysitter.
Yeah.
You know, maybe mess with that a little. Like, keep us on our toes.
Yeah, she's still the most boring character of the bunch, and I feel bad for her, but then I also sort of blame her. I mean, I'm going to put this out there into the world. I don't think Zoe Saldana is a very good actor.
Oh, man. Ashley would be so happy to hear that. She does not like Zoe Saldana. I'm not crazy about her. I just think maybe
I agree that she has
a little fun stuff to do, you know?
Yeah, she has the least to do, but I feel like she's basically hired on by, you know, the people who wrote this to just be strong space chick.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, maybe pull back with some of the other characters a little bit and let and develop her personality a little more, because we didn't really get it in the first one. Nobody's going. Oh God, excuse me. Nobody's going to Guardians of the Galaxy to see Gamora.
No, but I mean, here's the thing: why I kind of put the blame on Zoe Saldana as much as I do the writers, and I put the blame on both of them. I think if Zoe Saldana had been able to do more with as little as she had, I mean, she would have had to rose to the occasion, but I think if she had been able to show them, like, I can kind of, you know, either through her body work or through her line delivery, that she can be as funny as the other characters, or she can bring a different kind of comedic texture, they would have written towards that. But because she's kind of, I think she thinks about this movie, I feel like she thinks about this movie as, this is just like Avatar, this is just like all the other movies that she's been in, Star Trek, all the other action sci-fi things she's been in. I think she doesn't really, I don't know, I don't want to speak for her, but it doesn't seem that she gets the tone of this movie as much. And so I felt like she didn't really bring it originally, so they kind of just like, okay, well, this is what you do, and all of your comedic chemistry is going to come from your interactions with Chris Pratt, and he's going to have to do all the heavy lifting as far as that goes.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think it's probably the fault of both of them. I'm not a huge Zoe Saldana fan, but she doesn't like,
she doesn't ruin the movie. Yeah.
She's just sort of there.
Yeah.
She's fine.
Yeah. When I say that, I don't think she's a very good actor. It's not that I think that she's really bad or amateurish or anything like that. I just feel like she's very single-minded in her approach to this type of stuff. And you can't really, if you look at all of her sci-fi action roles, there's not a lot of difference in the way she approaches it.
No.
Really. And that, or even her dramatic roles. Okay. So going off of that, let's talk about Kurt Russell, because I think this is the first time in a fucking long time that Marvel's actually had, is this a spoiler to say, a villain who actually is pretty cool and has something going on?
That is a spoiler. That is absolutely 100% a spoiler. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it yet, go back in time, stop yourself from hearing that, and then skip this next little bit. Kudos to them for bringing in Kurt Russell. Goddamn. Talk about perfect casting. Also, fun fact. In the 1980 sequence at the very beginning, apparently, very minimal CGI was used for that.
Because we see a young Kurt Russell. When they de-age him? Yeah.
Yeah, apparently it was mostly makeup and his wig and just, you know, acting.
Good lighting.
Like he's a younger person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It can be done, and it looked more convincing than, like, the other motion captured versions of that.
Yeah, I was very impressed when I saw that. But yeah, no, Kurt Russell is a fucking, he's a national treasure. He is a, just, I love him so much. He was great in Fast 8.
Mm-hmm.
He's so good in this. And you're right, he actually brings, like, so, for me, the first little chunk of this movie, like, the first act of it,
mm-hmm.
I was enjoying because it's funny and it's fun and there's action, but I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is the point of any of this? It just felt like random scenes
mm-hmm.
sort of connected together. And I was like having kind of a hard time getting into it just because it was so disconnected from
mm-hmm.
like plot. But then once you get the reveal with Ego, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Now I get you. Now I get where this is going. And it, like, sort of things fell into place for me in a really cool way.
Mm-hmm. Why I think he's a really good villain in this movie and why I think he's one of the better Marvel villains as far as the movies go is because the movie actually gives a shit about him. He's not just some weird guy with a weird face running around doing things.
Mm-hmm.
The movies actually gives him a lot to say and do, and he interacts with the characters, and he really challenges the characters and makes them, you know, question their place in all of this. Well, I think that's it.
And he's not just like villain posturing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he doesn't think of himself as a villain. He's not just like brooding and seething and evil. He has a point of view, and mm-hmm. at first they introduce you to his point of view. So when the twist comes that he's a bad guy, it's like, oh shit, like I don't know what to do with this, because you want to like him.
Mm-hmm.
You want everything to be okay, but you know that it's just not. And then there are some more reveals that make him super villainous that you're like, oh, that's fucked up, but in a good way.
Yeah, and it was one of the few times where I felt like the conflict of the story actually feels somewhat sophisticated. Like, there's, mm-hmm. it's not just like, we're gonna blow this whole fucking city up if you don't get this villain to be sucked up in a black hole by the end of the movie. There's a version of that happens, but there's an emotional context to make all of that matter.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And I think that's what James Gunn really does really well with both of these movies, is that they're rooted in character. And all of the action that happens and all the plot stuff that happens is always advancing the characters. As far as Marvel movies goes, he's sort of unique in that.
And that's why, you know, even though some of the jokes fell a little flat for me this time around, and
mm-hmm.
the first act felt very disconnected to me, that attention to the character, you know, what makes these individuals unique is what carried me through the film. So, overall, yeah. I don't think it was as good as the first one. But I did like a lot. To me, it's sort of the opposite of the first one. Like, the first one, I think the first two acts are so fucking good. Mm-hmm. And then the third act gets sort of cliche and a little boring. And in this one, I felt like the first act is a little disconnected and weird. But then the second two acts are really solid. So,
yeah, I get that. I kind of retroactively decided I liked the early stuff because I saw what it was leading up to. And I think on a second viewing, it wouldn't even register as a problem now. But I get what you're saying. And I still really enjoyed sort of the world building aspect, you know, the golden alien planet. And like, I really loved sort of the look of the movie. It has this kind of 80s arcade look.
And you have some of the best, you have some of the deepest cuts as far as Marvel Easter eggs and one of the best Stan Lee cameos so far that mm-hmm. Basically confirmed a fan theory, actually, which is pretty fun. I could get into that if you want.
That's okay.
Okay.
I
guess people are just going to have to hit me up on Twitter and
find out what that's all about.
Find out what that's all about. But yeah, there's some great cosmic Marvel world building. Marvel world building. That's hard to say. Great cosmic Marvel world building going on.
Yes. I will say that the CGI, it all looks good. It's all very expensive. It's all very slick. But to me, this one felt a little more airless than the first movie because there's so much CGI and it's so heavily aestheticized that sometimes I feel like these guys are hanging on wires with a green screen behind them. Mm-hmm. And whereas the first movie, I felt like there was a better mix of practical and CGI, so it always felt like there was a tactility to the worlds they're in. But I overall, I enjoyed the story so much that I didn't let that bother me so much.
I thought you were going to have more of a problem with this movie.
No, you know, I think I like both movies about equally. I think that there's a different deficits in each one, but they ultimately, I think they stack up about the same. I still love the characters.
Exactly. I think
it's not as naturally funny and there's less of a surprise because we know what they can do now.
I think that's why some people had a problem with it, was that like, it is sort of more of the same,
mm-hmm.
you know? So like, if you like the first one, you'll probably like this one a lot, but a lot of people, the first one surprised, you know, because it is pretty fresh.
And weird.
Certified
fresh. We definitely don't emphasize enough how weird these movies are in the grander scheme of things.
Oh my god. There's like a whole bit about a guy named Taserface. That's the character's name from the comics. Like, they used that wonderfully. Yeah, there's a mantis girl. Like, there's a man who's a planet. Like, it is bonkers. Okay, but now, I know we need to wrap up and get to the next movie.
Okay.
But here is the most important question.
Okay.
How do you think the soundtrack compares to the first one? Better soundtrack? Worse soundtrack? Because, I mean, the music is such a part of these movies.
Yeah, and it sets them apart. As far as the needle drops go and that kind of thing, the 80s, 70s power ballad rock or whatever, dad rock soundtracks, I would put that in the same category as the humor. It's kind of more of the same. It's a little bit more expected. They're leaning into it more. They know that it's part of their brand now, so it kind of takes the polish off the joke a little bit. It's a little forced every once in a while, but I still enjoyed it overall. It didn't hurt any of the problems with the movie. I didn't feel overall hurt the movie all that much. It was just noticed like, oh, you learned your dog trick in the first movie, and now the masters are making you do dog tricks in front of their guests.
That's such a cynical way of putting that, but I get what you're saying. Also, that did not answer my question.
It's fine. I mean, it's not as memorable. I can't even tell you what the soundtrack was.
I think it's better.
Okay. It seemed more emotionally driven, maybe?
That, and I think there's some less obvious choices, whereas the first one, you know, you've got Hooked on a Feeling, you've got, mm-hmm. you know, the Pina Colada song, which mm-hmm. I think is one of the worst classic rock songs of all time. Go ahead, fight me, Twitter.
I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
In this one, there was just a lot more, I think, again, deeper cuts that I was like, to me, it felt like it fits, like you said, I think that it fit the story a little more than the first one. So. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there are slightly more obscure tracks, and I think that was a benefit.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I don't have to go out and buy the soundtrack, though, because I have to listen to that kind of music all day at work and whatever.
yeah, I don't know. There's something about it, though, when it's blasted over a monster eating people that.
Yeah, it's integrated in the movie, and it doesn't register as, you know, whatever. It's whatever it's supposed to register as. But
right. It's letter grade time. What are we giving Guardians of the Galaxy?
I think it's a solid B. Like I said, I liked it just about as much as the first one.
Okay. I'd give it a B+.
Yeah, I'm about there with you.
Okay.
Let's get into this, the Netflix homework. This is a direct-to-Netflix movie, just came out in February, that you assigned me last week. I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. This is directed by Mason Blair. I don't know if it's Macon or Mason, and Mason is a real name. Who is a star of both of Jeremy Saulnier's works, Blue Ruin and Green Room. I feel like he brought a whole lot of Saulnerian, cinematic language to his, directorial debut. So the movie's about a girl played by Melanie Lynskey, who doesn't feel at home in this world anymore. And, she's a nurse and she's sort of having sort of an existential crisis. Maybe she's clinically depressed. Her house gets broken into, and she feels violated and scared about that, and she decides to take the law into her own hands, because the cops don't seem to really care all that much about her stolen computer and some meds and some spoons from her grandmother. She runs into a quirky neighbor, played by Elijah Wood, Tony, who is going to help her on her journey to find these things, and it leads her into a dark world of suburban gang activity that she never knew about. And the movie gets surprisingly dark and violent as it goes on.
Yeah, it does.
What did you think of the movie you had me watch last week?
I dug it.
You were way into it?
Yeah. I don't know. I think maybe I connected a little too much with Melanie Lynskey character at the beginning. It is very you said this about the about Get Out, feels like a very post-Trump film. Like, it's just like the, you know, this woman just sort of going through her life. She feels like she's not able to do anything to affect any real change to the world. And then when the world sort of brings this awful shit to her home, she's like, no, I have to do something about this. And what she ends up doing is horribly bad and doesn't work out in her favor, really. But it gives her that agency that she needs in her life. And so I really like that aspect. I think it's something that a lot of people can probably connect with nowadays. Just judging off of Twitter and Facebook outrage, and, you know, just that idea of, like, you're helpless against something and just taking it in your own hands. So I connected with that aspect of it. And then it gets into, like, a sort of noirish story. About suburban. I don't know. It honestly, like, the movie itself, like, you can obviously see its influence. Like, it reminded me a lot of early Coen brothers, like Raising Arizona era, at least for the first little bit of it. But then when it gets super dark, it gets super dark, and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, or even Blood Simple. There's a lot of, like, that kind of stuff going on here.
Yeah, and I just appreciate that. In a, you know, it's definitely a, it's like a genre pick trying to set itself in as real of a depiction of the world as possible. Kind of like Brick. Did you ever see that movie with Jay Lett?
Yeah, I have it.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, taking a noir style story and setting it in a high school. That's sort of what this felt like to me, was let's take this sort of capery story and set it in suburban, you know, just normal Boringsville.
Yeah, there's a decent amount of blue velvet going on here, too.
Yeah.
I think especially in the, like, you know, the deeper you look into, like, a small thing and, like, you get, you know, you descend into these deeper levels of suburban hell.
Yeah, exactly. And, but there's, a lot of idiosyncratic quirk, a lot of really sort of dark, deadpan humor. That I really, you know, I felt like was really, really fun. I really liked Elijah Wood's performance.
Totally committed. Yeah.
Yeah. Melanie Lynskey also is always a treat. I dug it.
I liked parts of it.
Here we go.
Here's my issues with the movie. I agree with everything you're saying. For the most part. Except for the part where I think it works. I don't think the movie works all that well. And I think the movie has some serious tone problems. And yeah, I get that it's trying to go for this, like, David Lynch-y sort of, like, Blue Velvet-y sort of turn on a dime kind of thing. But it doesn't have as steady of a directorial hand on it to make those kind of shifts without it just seeming jarring. I feel like there's three movies in this movie that are always competing. You have this kind of quirky Sundance drama in the style of like a Garden State or a Sunshine Cleaning or something like that with the Melanie Lynskey story, her character stuff. And then you have this ultra-violent, dark suburban noir, which feels a lot like the Jeremy Saulnier films, especially Green Room. And then you have this kind of Napoleon Dynamite-ish character that Elijah Wood is playing in here. I mean, and it's as broad as Napoleon Dynamite, or as broad as, like, the Eagle versus Shark character Jermaine Clement plays. And it's somehow he's supposed to fit into, or in between, or these two different worlds that are going on in this movie. And to me, just none of it ever really comes together. I believe all that stuff individually, but the combination thereof makes it feel like a very much a first-time director just kind of doing all the things he's always wanted to do. Slash, very tethered to his influences, sometimes distractingly so.
I'm going to have to politely agree to disagree to agree. What's our fucking logo?
Rod always says this
tagline.
Rod always says this on the listening party too. He forgets which order it goes. Okay, yeah. Explain why I'm wrong.
To me, it worked. Like I didn't think. I mean, Elijah Wood's definitely playing a weirdo, which he is wont to do. But to me, it was pretty believable weirdo. Like yeah, it has kind of a Napoleon. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he was in Napoleon Dynamite. Mm-hmm. But I've also met people like that, so to me, it was believable, and he, I think, injected a lot of heart into the movie that it needed, and in contrast to her character. In particular, also the only thing is, I will say, when it gets really dark and violent, that is pretty jarring. That was pretty abrupt and like, whoa, what the fuck? But I liked that actually. And it might not have been entirely intentional. I will concede that. That there is a tonal shift in the movie that might not have been purposeful, but to me it worked, because all of a sudden I was like super invested, and like the stakes were pretty real for me, and I actually like really gave a shit about how the characters turned out.
Well, I think the tonal shifts are intentional. I just don't think that they are steered with enough of a steady hand to be able to work in the way that he thinks it's working.
I I don't know. It worked for me.
All right.
Yeah.
Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I feel like as a whole, it was pretty well put together. My biggest complaint is I do think it is a little derivative. Like, it is, you know, I don't know that there isn't anything in there that I haven't seen in, you know, a Coen Brothers movie done maybe better. I don't know. But I don't know. The characters all stood out to me. I really liked the villain and how creepy that was.
Well, again, I feel like they're in another movie. If you're talking about, like, there's, like, I guess there's like, levels of villains in this, because there's, like, the kid who broke in the house, and then his gang leader, and then his dad, and they're all kind of, like, bad in different ways. And they all are giving interesting performance. My favorite scene in the movie, and I would think is sort of the centerpiece of the movie, is when they go to talk to his dad, and they think they have all this leverage on them, and it sort of starts out sort of comedically in sort of a way that, again, I don't really feel fits what they're going for. But then it develops further when the father comes home, and they have this very, very serious one-on-one conversation. There's actually some very good, like, direction going on in that sequence. And that guy's giving a hell of a performance throughout the movie. And for a character that doesn't necessarily need that much attention, he's giving a really, really good performance.
But I feel like a lot of the characters were doing that. Like the creepy kid that breaks into the houses, like he's also really memorable to me. And even their weird sort of ringleader. The only one that didn't really work for me was the girl. I felt like she was a little over the top. And you know, there are touches of that in this movie. But for the most part, it worked for me. I dug it.
Yeah, the gang stuff in particular was the stuff that reminds me a lot of Jeremy Saulnier's movies. Blue Ruin and Green Room. So I'll say to you, if you like this movie, I think you're going to fucking love his movies. Definitely go see Blue Ruin. I think is one of the best, like, indie debuts of the last 15 years.
Well, didn't you hate Green Room?
Green Room I had some issues with, and a lot of the same issues that I have with this movie, actually. But Richard loved it, and everybody, and it has a very high rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so I might be wrong about that movie.
All right.
But yeah, I ultimately I'd say if you like any of the things that we're talking about, this might be an interesting curiosity to check out. I personally thought that it ultimately doesn't add up to much, as cool as some of individual things about it are.
I think if you're looking for a strange thriller on a Saturday afternoon, you could do a lot worse.
Okay.
Like to me, it reminded me a lot of, like, when I watched Brick, or when I watched Donnie Darko, or these, like, quirky movies that you're like, what is going on? You know, and it's just sort of like a what is this film sort of thing. But then by the end of it, I'm totally sucked in. That's sort of what this was to me.
Well, it's definitely a ride. All right. Next week we're going to watch, you know what, I'm going to change my mind on this, because we did just talk about a thriller. Let's go ahead and watch Nerdland.
Okay.
This is a film that was created by Titmouse. Was it originally released for Adult Swim? Or did it have a theatrical run? I don't remember.
I believe it had a theatrical run.
It's an animated film, and we'll be talking about that next week.
Also, just want to point out that I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore has a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, so you might just be wrong about some movies, Cassidy.
Well, if I was certified on Rotten Tomato, I'd bring that grade down a little.
Oh, you bitch.
You
shady, shady asshole.
If anybody has anything that they want to let us know about today's episode, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com.
We threw down some gauntlets in this episode.
I feel good. This was definitely a declarative episode.
That's right. No more pussyfooting around.
jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can contact us there if you have any opinions about the opinions that we had today. I'm sure that some of the people who listen have more to say about the Daredevil stuff. Or Daredevil.
Jesus Christ. Revoke this man's nerd card. And you're giving me shit about missing free comic book day?
Hellboy stuff. You can also contact us on Twitter at JabberPodcast. You can find our archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can find our RSS feed. We're also available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Google Play, and the Windows Podcast Network, which you don't need anymore because you have a new phone, and hopefully you didn't buy yourself another Windows phone.
No, I got an Android.
Look at you.
I know. I feel simultaneously dirty and very, very happy because it is shiny and fast and fun.
So now you can listen to people's podcasts without them using the one network nobody uses. Oh, do we want to mention how Guardians of the Galaxy had a Zune bit?
Yeah.
the fact that we use Zune still is such a joke that it is now in a feature film. Just the joke itself.
Yeah, I still have mine.
So do I. Still use it.
I made the joke to Ashley that I was like, you know what, he's lucky he didn't get handed an iPod Shuffle, because, like, of all the MP3 players, he got the best one.
Mm-hmm. Except for its software doesn't work on any computer anymore.
He's in fucking space! He doesn't care. He's upgrading from a cassette tape.
All right. Blah, 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 blah. There was more stuff I was going to say. No, there isn't. Where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. They can find me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. They can find me on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Also, check out Tonight in San Diego. We are coming back. We're coming back. Our first live taping will be Monday, May 22nd. Oh, Jesus Christ, that's so soon. Just a lot of work getting back into it. This will come out Thursday, right?
Yeah.
I have a show. Tonight in San Diego is doing a variety show this Friday at Winston's Beach Club in Ocean Beach. Come check it out. This is going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be stand-up. There's going to be improv. There's going to be music. Should be a good time. I'm also doing stand-up I'm also doing stand-up at Home and Away in Old Town San Diego on Wednesday, May 24th at 8:30. Come check that out. Also, go to tonightinsandiego.com. Follow Tonight in San Diego on Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff. I think that's it for me.
Cool. And be sure to listen to our friends out there who also do podcasts. We have Ron Denise at The Listening Party. And Mascot Diaries, and we have Patrick and his dad at Make Dad Read Comics, Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational. That's it, and we're not going to have an episode next week because I want our 200th episode to be the Alien Covenant episode, and we are going to bring back Richard Wally. He said he was going to be on the show.
Cute.
Mm-hmm. And I'm flirting with the idea. We'll see what happens. But if we get enough people to respond either via Twitter at Jabber Podcast or email jabberinthedrone@gmail.com, if you send us enough questions, we might do a little short AMA in the podcast.
Oh, that'd be fun. Send us your questions.
And it doesn't have to be movie related. It could be about us personally. Where did we meet? Where did we go to high school? That kind of stuff. Or
it could be like weird movie stuff that maybe we don't know. Try to stump us. Or it could be weird, not movie stuff that we don't know. I know some comic stuff. I know general pop culture stuff. I don't know enough about politics. Bring on the questies.
Okay, so that'll be that, and we'll talk to you next time.
Did you see the trailer for the new Blade Runner, the full extended trailer?
I didn't.
They gave it to Gosling.
They sure did. Bye.